Welcome to Cynicism.
Holy shit, Nick.
What's that, Brent?
You're making me do something so difficult this week.
what are you?
You're making me pick my top 10 movies of the last decade.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
Some good movies.
I didn't know how much work this was going to be. I should have known how hard it was to do 2019 by itself. Now I got to do 10 more of those. More of those.
I mean, it's 2020 now. We just came to the close of the last decade. It's that time. It's right. But it's hard.
It's hard.
I'll give you it's hard.
And so I cheated.
Oh, no. What'd you do?
I mean, I cheated.
Did you steal somebody's list?
No. I made my own damn list.
Good.
I went through and I Googled all the movies that I didn't know what years certain movies came out in. And I wanted to be like, okay, do I have movies within the certain time frame?
Yeah.
And then I was like, God damn it. This is so fucking hard. I'm just going to pick my favorite movie from each year.
I like it. Why not?
And then I'm gonna tell you guys what my favorite movie was from each year. Now, this may not necessarily be like a top 10 of the decade, but it's definitely like a top for each year for the last decade.
It's a good way to highlight a movie from each year of the decade. Give you the full span to the decade, you know?
There were some years that were more difficult than others. I definitely struggled in 2017.
Okay.
And I think 2018. Oh man. I looked at those years and I was like, I could definitely say all three of these, but
not all years are created equally.
Exactly. 2016 is the worst.
Yeah, I think for me 2015 is probably my weakest. I'm not going to go through charts and look, but that's what I remember off the top of my head. I'm kind of doing it a little differently, a little more classically top 10. I'll be honest, this is something I've kind of been working on for ages. I've been on my Letterboxd for maybe 6 years already. So I've been doing ranking each year, and I've gone back to all the past years too over time. So actually in my notepad to come down with the list I finally have today, I was able to finally cut it down to my top 125 movies of the decade. And even that took, I don't know, a couple days, a few weeks.
Yeah, see, I wasn't about to start on that whole thing.
Yeah.
I was having a hard enough time, and I was looking through, I was like, oh, there's so many good ones.
Yeah, and I mean, what I'm definitely going to do, because of, there's only so much time you guys want to spend listening to our voices.
Yep.
We're going to keep it to 10. I will share on social media a link to my full 125 if you want to check that out. So if you're really just hardcore movie nerd or just
a masochist who just loves to hurt themselves.
Or if you just want to argue with me on social media, this is a good way to do so.
Hey, Nick loves to argue on social media.
I'm a fan of arguing. If you ever need somebody to fight with on movies, it's N. Muldoon on Twitter. I'm really excited to get into this. I think for me, so I have to just start by saying, I think I'm so excited because I had done a top 10 list or top 25 or whatever for the previous decade.
Right.
But I was 20 when I made it, and I was having to kind of play catch up on movies. You know, obviously 2001 rolls around. I'm 11 years old. I'm not seeing every art film that comes out.
Are you seeing every art film now?
Not every art film. I try to see, I try to get the highlights. This is the first decade where I definitely was seeing every single thing that came out. And also I just remember when I was 20 going through that list, I was doing a lot of what are the critics okay, well they gotta be right. So that's probably more important than my own opinion.
So now we've got a more opinionated hot takes list from you this time.
I will say, cause I have seen some of the critics lists of this decade.
Disappointing?
It depends on the critic you're reading.
All
right. But I would say in terms of that, I would say expect some surprises from me.
Okay.
Because of my list is neither similar to like the box office stuff or necessarily critics' lists. I definitely have a few movies critics like that you won't see on my list.
Okay.
And vice versa. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
There's going to be some hot takes. I'm sure you probably got some hot takes yourself.
Oh, I definitely got some good ones in here.
So
I will say this is going to be a long one. And because our last couple of episodes were so long, we're going to get from 2010...
On your list.
On my list to 2014. And then with Nick, we're going to go 10 through 6.
Yeah. Yeah. That way we, you know, you're not listening to, I don't know, 3 full hours of us or whatever this ends up being.
Right. So you'll hear my takes and you'll hear Nick's takes up until that point, and then we'll do it to be continued, and then we'll carry on in the next episode.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to start talking about this decade, so what better way to start this decade than the year that started this decade?
Well, okay, so because my list is the film that I found to be the best from that year,
mm-hmm.
or at least my favorite from that year, 2010, Edgar Wright's Scott Pilgrim. Holy shit.
Great movie.
That's a great movie. It's a comic book adaptation starring Michael Cera as the titular Scott Pilgrim. It's got, what's the guy from Igby Goes Down?
Kieran Culkin.
Kieran Culkin. It's got Kieran Culkin. I love him.
Now on Succession.
What's that?
He's now on Succession.
Oh, cool. I don't know what that is. Is that a TV show?
Yeah, it's a big HBO show.
Well, it's super funny, visually striking. Like, the editing is just, like, on point. Like, there's so many visual gags that just, like, crack me up. And they keep it pretty true to, like, the comic book series, too. At least, like, from, like, dialogue and the way certain scenes look. You got Chris Evans of, like, Avengers fame in there as one of the evil ex-boyfriends. Super funny, visually enticing, and I think it still kind of holds up pretty well these days.
Yeah, I love that pick. I'm unabashedly an Edgar Wright fanboy, and I'm a big Scott Pilgrim fan, both of the comic and the movie.
Yeah.
I actually, that's one of my favorite viewing experiences of the decade. I went up to Toronto for the midnight of that when it got released.
Yeah.
And it was great because
that's a great place to go see it because yeah. It's based in Toronto.
And obviously in the movie they put up those little blurbs saying like each place and they're all real places in Toronto.
Yeah, Lee's Palace is where the Battle of the Bands is. Yeah. I went and saw a couple of bands there recently.
So. And I remember each time one came up, people literally stood up and started clapping in the theater and cheering.
That's
fun. It was so cool. But yeah, you made a really good point there about the editing. Because yeah. I think there's not a better edited film of the whole decade. Just because of, I mean, editing so often can create like a tempo or a rhythm for the film. But the way Edgar Wright uses editing to tell a joke is so brilliant and so creative. And I don't know that I've ever seen anybody do it that way before.
He's great with that because he uses it in all of his movies. In like this particular film, like you may not have seen Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
But like you probably saw this movie because you're like, Michael Cera. I love Michael Cera from Arrested Development, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I always just think back to that scene early on where they're all walking down the streets in Toronto talking about how this party's going to suck. And then it just jump cuts to them like exactly mirrored just going, this party sucks. And it's
I'm bored. Like there's so many good bits.
Such a brilliant gag. Yeah, that's such a good pick. And visually, it's insane. It's
nothing like it, at least at that time frame that I had ever seen, because it felt like a blend of like anime and just live action. It has really good like fight scenes. The soundtrack for that fucking
incredible
movie is so good. I still go back and like listen to it.
That's the other thing I think that's great about that movie is obviously we're talking about the decade and we're just here to talk about like our favorite movies of the decade, but there's something interesting about looking back at this list as well in terms of how it represents this decade. And that does feel like such a time capsule of, like, a time and a place of, like, when, like, indie still kind of meant something. You know, these people are in indie bands. They're going to record stores. There's all these, like, underground parties. Like it, and that soundtrack again. You mentioned Broken Social Scenes on there, Metrics on there, all these big Toronto indie artists. You know, it kind of feels like a perfect time capsule of sort of the start of this decade that we're talking about and the end of the last one.
Mm-hmm.
So such a fucking good pick.
Such a wonderful movie.
I love that.
Well, I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. So. Moving on from your 2010 pick, we're going to go into my number 10 pick, which honestly I feel like is kind of similar in a way in that it's a comedy that's very colorful and bright. I've already kind of talked about it recently, and it is Booksmart.
Ooh.
I've said before, I just love this film, like it, the pure like empathy and warmth of it. You know, I try to think of like, looking back, like the movies that we're truly going to spend like the rest of our lives watching. And, you know, there's a lot of truly great, sort of powerful dramas out there. And that, I mean, I appreciate those. I value those. But when I think back to like the great films of maybe the 1980s, right? I'm not probably going to watch Raging Bull 100 times, even if I can appreciate it. But I'm going to watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off a million times. That's going to be my comfort movie. And that's what Booksmart kind of is for me for this decade. It has two characters, and it's really about that friendship and about kind of the empathy and warmth for just everybody around them. And it is about kind of having to understand other people to be seen in return. And also, it's just so fucking funny.
It's hilarious.
I don't know that any movie makes me laugh that hard. It's already become one of these things where it's been out maybe not even a year yet, and like if it's 11 o'clock, 12 on like a weekday, and I'm like kind of half paying attention, this isn't a diss to it. If anything, it's a compliment. I just want something on that's going to make me feel chilled out, and then I'm going to be able to like look up and laugh and have a good time. Like, I'll put Booksmart on like once every other week now. Like, it's in a rarefied air. Like, there's movies I do that with, like Rushmore, Ferris Bueller, you know. These movies I return to time and time again. And I wanted my top 10 to have at least one kind of just pure comedy on that.
Nice.
So, yeah, I absolutely love Booksmart. You saw it on my top 10 of 2019. And
kicking here off, it is, making its return.
It's kicking off our best of the decade.
In high regard, too. Like, you know, top 10 of the decade.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful movie. It, like you said, colorful. It has an awesome soundtrack, too,
again,
as well. Just, like, something about, like, comedies with good soundtracks and bright visuals that just, like, strike us.
Yeah,
that's really important.
And I think too, you know, it's something I mentioned in terms of Scott Pilgrim, but I feel like in terms of working as a time capsule too, that applies to Booksmart. You know, if Scott Pilgrim kind of was maybe what social cultures were at the beginning of the decade, and that kind of wonderful sort of like, you know, era we grew up in, or maybe came of age in.
It definitely caps off the decade
yeah,
in a strange way.
This kind of feels like the sort of social climate that maybe I'm not in because I'm a little bit older than the protagonist.
Because you're
not
in high school anymore.
Yeah, but it feels like this generation. It feels like the next step forward for that. Yeah, really, really great movie. So
awesome.
Let's get into your...
Gonna go to 2011 right now.
Another year.
All right. Pedro Almodovar's The Skin I Live In from 2011. Easily one of the weirdest movies I've seen in the last decade, but also like the weirdest movie with an actual narrative.
Yeah.
That doesn't give everything away like from the top. So like as you're watching the movie, characters evolve in a way that is truly terrifying mm-hmm. and like upsetting. It's beautiful. Like in a definite, and like, it's one of the first times I think I've ever seen Antonio Banderas in a movie where I was just like, holy shit, dude. Like,
yeah.
You're fucking incredible, and also, what the hell?
yeah, no, that's a really good pick. I love Pedro Almodovar. I love, especially when Antonio Banderas works with him. And it is such a weird movie, as you say. It is kind of, it walks sort of certain genre lines where you can't really place it. At
yeah.
times, it kind of feels like a horror movie. Other times, it kind of almost becomes like dark comedy.
It's got some strange, like, love narratives that are, like, interplaying throughout.
A very dark romance story.
Yeah.
It's almost like a very even, like, darker, twisted version of Vertigo in a lot of ways. And I like it, too, because of another thing that Elmo Odovar always does in his films is he likes to play sort of with the ideas of gender and sexuality. And I like that the movie's, like, unafraid to do that.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't back down at all from that one.
Yeah. And, it's a really beautiful, interesting film that's also very disturbing.
Yeah. It's, like, at times, like, you see some of the imagery and you go, wow, this is very striking and beautiful. But at the same time, what you're looking at is just like, oh, this is...
It's, like, the most beautiful way to frame something that's completely grotesque.
Yeah. Yeah. There are wonderful dresses in this film. There is a wonderful, like, set design. Like, the wallpaper in this movie, I think, like, really stuck out in certain places. I just, like, I can distinctly remember it, and I still talk about it. And that's one of the reasons why I picked it for 2011, is because, like, I saw other movies then, and I was like, these are fine.
Yeah.
But this one, I would tell people to watch this one still.
Yeah.
I would also give them a warning.
Yeah. Like, prepare yourself. It's you're like, in for something.
It's like, you're not ready.
Yeah.
Trust me.
You know what's kind of funny about this list, though, right now, Brian? We're doing a lot of, like, weirdly linking up. in terms of just maybe, like, the types of movies we're picking.
Mm.
So my number 9, a lot of the things that we just used to describe The Skin I Live In could describe this movie.
Oh, jeez.
Supremely fucked up.
Oh.
Disturbing. Visually stunning. Yeah, so my number 9 is Ari Aster's Hereditary.
Ooh-wee.
This is one of the only movies I've ever watched that has made me feel physically ill in a theater.
I watched that movie multiple times and felt...
Yeah.
I felt like I was going to throw up.
This was like his debut horror film, and it stars Toni Collette, and I think that's one of like the best horror performances I've ever seen in my life. What I like about Ari Aster's movies is it kind of feels like you're watching a horror movie version of his own therapy session. Like, everything traces back into something in his life. And it does play with this kind of idea of, like, inherited grief and inherited stress. Like, the idea of what we as people don't deal with, and how we put that on to those around us. So in kind of a weird way, it is kind of the perfect, like... advertisement for please go to therapy.
Please pay attention to what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And don't just put it into your art.
Yeah. Like if you're feeling some sort of way, maybe talk to somebody. But he has a really like gifted hand at just creating really terrifying, brutal imagery. But his work never feels sadistic to me. It feels like he kind of holds off on showing you almost anything, and then knows how to sort of relay something that feels so brutal and striking that you don't know how to deal with it when it finally is presented in front of you. I don't know that I've seen a horror film quite like Hereditary, maybe since the like origin of like the current horror boom, like the 1970s. It feels sort of like a movie that would be in that era. You know, I think of films like The Exorcist or films like Rosemary's Baby or, you know, these kind of, a lot of early Cronenberg too. Like these films that are kind of sort of more modest dramas that become something a lot darker and more nefarious. And yeah, just it's such a powerful film. I wasn't able to shake it. And then still, like, I can't watch that movie by myself as many times as I've seen it. I don't know that I've ever jumped as hard in my entire life at a clicking sound. True story, I went to go see this movie when I was living in Manchester with a friend of mine. And a couple days later, we were at work and I went down to the ice cellar to get more ice. And he literally snuck up behind me and just clicked. And I literally...
What an asshole.
I literally just on gut reaction turned around and punched him. And then I felt so bad.
I mean, he had to know it was coming.
I mean, like, right in the face. Like,
it's like,
my dude was on the floor. I felt bad, but
I mean,
also,
if you know what that shit means, like, you know what's gonna happen.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, to me, it was he should have prepared himself.
Yeah, and I also wanted to include Hereditary too, because I feel like one of the things about the 2010s as a decade is it's kind of like, it's an era where horror became truly important again.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many filmmakers that emerged over the past decade.
It's pretty much the most exciting decade for horror in a long time.
Yeah, I would go so far as going back to the 1980s and that boom to really see anything equivalent or close to it. And, you know, you had filmmakers. It became sort of this idea that if you were an independent filmmaker who wanted a decent chance of both seeing your movie getting seen and also wanting to get funding from studios, the easy way was to make a horror movie because they're cheap enough to make, and there's always an audience for it. But what that's resulted in is probably most of the most gifted filmmakers over the last decade emerging in this genre. You know, people like Ari Aster, Robert Eggers, Jordan Peele, Jennifer Kent. You know, you have amazing filmmakers coming up through it. And yeah, for me, I love all of those filmmakers, but this was the one that, like, I couldn't shake.
Yeah, that movie fucks with you. I remember coming back from the theater and just sitting on my front porch, afraid to go into my own house.
Yeah.
Because I was like, there's dark corners in my house, and I'm by myself, and I'm going to watch the Christopher Robin trailer one more time. I'm gonna calm myself down, please.
I need some Piglet in my life before I go into that house.
Even after, it was still very difficult. I had to turn all the lights on.
I don't blame you.
Oh, man, that's wonderful. Let's move into 2012.
Let's do it.
All right, so I got a good one here. This is definitely a big one for me.
Okay.
P.T. Anderson's The Master.
Ooh.
Holy fucking shit. I love this movie. I have never seen some of the these are some of the best performances I've seen come out of Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it being kind of like loosely based on Scientology and like how all that went down. Just like, it really resonates with me to like watch people just get like at this battle of like emotion and like control, and you have Joaquin Phoenix's character who is just beyond that and is like only just like going with what he's interested in, and he's loyal to an extent, but after a certain point just kind of animalistic nature takes over.
It's an exchange of power dynamics almost throughout.
Yeah, and you just got like, you got these wonderful scenes where it's like you get to see like what he sees at times, where he's just sitting in a room and he's just imagining everyone naked. I'm like, oh, okay. it's one of the few times where like you actually get to be inside of that character's head and see what they're seeing. And then there's another time where like you're just like close up in Philip Seymour Hoffman's face and he's just singing and he's just so sweaty and puffy, and it's just like,
yeah,
it's gross.
That's what I really love about that movie too, is because of with that, Paul Thomas Anderson chose to shoot in 70mm, and normally with 70mm, you kind of think that's normally reserved for films like Lawrence of Arabia, you know, Bridge on River Kwai, like these big grand epics, and he's doing it pretty much just for close-ups of faces. So you sort of see like every kind of contour of the characters' faces and every little piece or tick of their performance, and it just consumes the entire screen. And yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen close-ups that look quite like they do in this film.
It's like unsettling in a way. I referred to it as a masterpiece in framing, like how all the shots are just framed up. You have the jail scene where Joaquin and Philip are in like two different cells and they're acting very differently.
Yeah.
Like Joaquin basically breaks a sink off of the wall, and it wasn't scripted. He just fucking did it. I was like, that's incredible. And like the fact that you kind of get to dive into a little bit of the lore of Scientology in a sense. Like, this isn't Scientology like what's happening in the movie, but a lot of the things that they're mirroring come from that, like this boat where everybody gets on the boat, and like these tapes where they're recording like their deepest thoughts and fears, and basically like handing it over to the master of the religion,
right,
Seymour Hoffman. And then you have Amy Adams in this movie, and she's pretty wonderful as well. Just like watching her and the way she controls Philip too, it's like, yeah, oh geez, it's like, it's all the balance of power is just all over the place.
Yeah, it does feel almost at times like she's almost kind of like the one behind everything.
Yeah,
at least in terms of the religion. Yeah, that's a really great movie. Also another thing there too is the score by Johnny Greenwood in this movie is incredible. It's a really, really stunning film. I don't think this is going to be the last time you hear about it on this podcast. So stay tuned. But all I'm going to say is, great pick.
I love this movie.
So then moving right along for me, I'm going to go into my number 8. And I'm going to say this is probably the film that the least amount of people listening to this have probably heard of. Gonna try to take a guess here and say you probably have not heard of this movie.
Ooh, okay.
It's called Oslo, August 31st.
Don't know this movie.
This is a film by Joachim Trier, who is a Norwegian filmmaker. He's one of probably my favorite filmmakers who's debuted over the last decade. And what he kind of likes to do is make these very personal dramas about life and people coming of age sort of in their 20s and like early 30s. And it's about basically a drug addict who has been in rehab for, we don't really get a full stretch of like the amount of time, but he's finally returning home from rehabilitation. And with it, he's supposed to basically make his rounds and sort of, you know, apologize to people or make amends to people in his life from when he was an addict. But also he's just struggling to stay clean and kind of find purpose in his life after rehab. And in a lot of ways, this could sound like it's the dreariest movie in the world. And I'm not going to lie, there's moments of this that are pretty devastating. But it's also just kind of really smart in the way friendships and relationships change as you age, and kind of what those points in your life are like as you grow older, you know, and that kind of aimlessness of being in your 20s or 30s and not having found like a defined career or path yet in your life. It's a really powerful film, but it's also just visually stunning. There's a scene in here that I think is one of my favorites of the decade, where it's kind of just, without ruining it for anybody who I hope does see it, essentially they just go to a party, and then after there's just a scene of them probably at like 3 or 4 in the morning riding through Oslo on their bicycles and like going up and down hills, and it's some of the most beautiful cinematography I've like ever seen. And it's just a really unique and powerful film. The screenplay is incredible too. Just all of these characters who inhabit this world feel so fully realized. And you understand kind of why these friendships would have made sense and probably why or how they've gotten frayed. It's maybe, and this probably is not the best pitch to get people to be like, ooh, want to throw that on a Tuesday night. but it's maybe the best film I've seen about depression in the whole decade.
Okay.
You know, as someone who myself, I struggle with depression. Well, when I watch this, there's a lot in this film that I identified with. And that I also see in people who are close to me. And I found it really, really powerful and insightful in terms of what that living like that is kind of like.
Yeah, because I think sometimes people don't realize that they're depressed. Like, they just know they feel bad.
Yeah.
And they know what depression looks like. They just don't know that that's the name for it.
Right. And I think there's also a thing where people who necessarily don't have depression don't understand the kind of all-consuming weight of it when you're in that place. And so it's kind of just like that, like, oh, we're going to a party later, you know, cheer up, it'll be fun then. And it's like, no, it's kind of just like kind of constantly trying to stave off the thing that feels like it's like consuming my brain. And this movie captures that in a way that I feel like few have. And it's a really beautiful film. And Joachim Trier is an incredible filmmaker. He also made a film called Reprise, which is sort of just about like two poets and or authors in their like mid-20s and kind of struggling with one getting more famous than the other and how their friendship falls apart. And just if you like movies about friendships and relationships and how they change and as you grow, this is kind of the perfect filmmaker to really invest in. So that's why that's my number 8 on my list.
That's a pretty good pick. I like when films tackle like mental health and like in a way that's really impactful to you, and like it's teaching you at least how to identify and maybe not necessarily coping mechanisms that are beneficial, but
right,
like it's the first step to recovery is admitting that you got an issue.
Yeah.
So all right, so we're moving into 2013 territory. This might be a movie from this is definitely one of my favorite directors. I'm realizing it as of today after like making this list. This
yeah.
is definitely one of my favorite directors. Alfonso Cuarón, Gravity.
Okay.
And I just remember being so excited for this movie, regardless that Sandra Bullock is in it and what's his face?
George Clooney. Yeah.
That guy.
you know, old what's his face.
The old what's his face. It was like Time's sexiest man, like
four times,
a bunch of times.
Yeah,
like people like how sexy George Clooney is from ER. Well, Gravity in 2013 was one of those films where I was just super excited to see it before I even got to the theaters. I distinctly remember being in such a rush to get to the theaters. I was like, oh, I didn't eat yet. And so I went through a McDonald's parking. Well, I went to a McDonald's drive through and got one of those like 20-piece chicken McNuggets.
Ooh, live large.
I ate all of them before the movie, which was not a great idea.
I love that.
Because I smelled like chicken nuggets throughout the movie. It's all I could smell, but...
So you always associate Gravity in the back of your mind with the smell of chicken nuggets.
Yes, actually I do. I just remember hearing like about all the technical achievements and that chicken nuggets are not to be eaten in large quantities before watching this particular movie.
It's weird that more people don't talk about chicken nuggets in relation to Gravity. Honestly, I'm a bit shocked.
But it was just like... this movie was like flipping me around. I love the way the camera like is like right on her face at times and like spinning her. They created special light boxes to create realistic lights on her face, and like also just some parts of the film where I was genuinely impressed with how they did zero gravity. Loved that there's also like a really wonderful shot where she's just kind of like calm and restful, and she's just floating in like a fetal position next to a window, and I'm like, oh, this is wonderful, and kind of goes along with one of the main themes of being reborn after experiencing like a severe tragedy. And there's lots of tragedy in this
yeah.
movie. You spend the majority of the film with Sandra Bullock, and like not always been like a huge fan, but I have seen her at times where I'm just like, oh, I do enjoy this. Like Miss Congeniality, I'm not gonna lie, I do like those
good
movies.
Good comedy.
I do like those movies. And I also like this. It's very different. But it's also just like I felt like uneasy at times because I didn't know what was gonna happen. I didn't know like what the next thing was gonna be. And when the movie was over, I felt pretty happy. I was like,
yeah.
I was like, oh, that was satisfying in a way that I was not anticipating it to be. I know there's a lot of people out there saying like the physics were off. That's not how things work in space. I'm like, I don't know. I don't care. I've never been to outer space. It looked wonderful, and it made me like sit on the edge of my seat while I was
yeah.
watching most bits.
I'll say two things to that. First, if you're that type of person, shut up. Go away. Stop watching movies. Nothing annoys me more than people who don't have any suspension of disbelief. Like, it's the whole process of going to a movie is just investing in the fiction they're giving you.
Right.
If you can't do that, you don't know how to watch art or consume art. But the other thing is, like, it, as you're saying, the other thing about that movie, though, when you're talking about when that came out, it was just, like, the pure spectacle of it, too. Like, obviously, that's the thing. It does have that emotional through line. But it is in this massive spectacle, like the kind of that nobody had really. I mean, it was during that era where 3D was kind of pushing filmmakers to try new things
in a bad way.
Yes, often in a bad way. Yeah. Sometimes good. You know, Gravity is a perfect example of that. And there's other 3D movies. I don't need to get blasted. I know a lot of people disagree with me. I'm still a big fan of Hugo, and I think Hugo is another movie that does 3D really well.
I am one of those people that disagrees with you, but I'll let you go.
But, you know, it is this, like, wonderful kind of emotional, personal story about grief and overcoming it, and, you know, in this kind of sci-fi spectacle. And, you know, it's a movie that comes from one of the best filmmakers working. And I think when you have somebody like that being able to harness this technology, that's when you do get something that's kind of truly special, like Gravity. Or at least just completely different than anything else on the marketplace.
Yeah, I just the vacuum of space in that movie and, like, the close-up shots, like, you feel just as lonely as she does, like, at times, and also just as joyful as she does when she is able to communicate with anybody, even if the language is different.
Yeah.
And that's really what made that movie stick out to me in 2013.
Yeah. All right. So my number 7 is probably the most divisive movie on my list. I've probably championed this movie to a lot of people and gotten reactions that are like, oh, great pick, and holy shit, why did you make me watch that movie? And I kind of understand both reactions. Spring Breakers is my number 7, and it is a bizarre film. It's a film that kind of takes place in the youth culture that started at the beginning of the decade in 2013. And with the kind of music that soundtracks that youth culture, it kind of uses the same techniques to tell its story. So, you know, we're thinking of dubstep and trap music. And what the film kind of does is it sort of edits scenes together in the same sort of rhythm as those music, like lines of dialogue become almost samples. We hear them repeated throughout the movie. You know, we get sort of these sort of dreamlike visions throughout the film that are just like overlaid with like ADR dialogue that, you know, sort of almost plays like narration, but also sort of just plays like kind of free jazz almost. But what I like about the movie is that it's visually stunning and kind of just this all-enveloping, like, immersive experience. Like, once you start the movie, it's either going to repulse you or intoxicate you, but it's about something. I think it's one of the smartest films of the decade because of underneath that, it really is talking about real issues of, like, gentrification, cultural appropriation, and sort of kind of the endless path that sort of life was on for many millennials when they were coming of age at that time, after the sort of recession of the late 2000s. You know, I always think to myself, you know, one of the first scenes in this movie, people kind of, again, they don't know how to engage with the film, so they miss things. You know, the very first scene we get are the two girls in class, and they're sort of joking around. They have their notepads, and they're drawing, like, dicks and just, like, dumb little phrases and kind of, like, mimicking, like, licking the piece of paper with the dick on it and kind of just goofing around, and people, like, if they're watching that, they're just like, all right, I already hate this movie, But the thing is, if you're paying attention to the scene, the entire time, like, their professor is talking about the civil rights movement. And it's people completely ignorant of the culture that later in the movie they profit off of. When they rob the diner to go on the spring break, you'll notice almost all of their victims are people of color. When later they are out of their spring break world, you find them, again, who is the rival here? It's a black gangster in this film, and it's played by Gucci Mane, who actually surprisingly good in this. But he literally gets the line in the movie of, these people want to take money from my family. They want to take food out of my baby's mouth. It is kind of this movie about sort of cultural appropriation and how people profit off of things created by people of color, but don't pay any respect or value to the people that they're profiting off of, or the pain that they're causing by sort of subjugating them. It's weird for this to be in the same movie as a Skrillex soundtrack and shots of Selena Gomez and Vanessa Hudgens doing coke together.
Selena Gomez is doing coke in this movie?
She is doing coke in this
movie. I saw her do it.
But it's kind of this movie where if you're not paying attention to what's happening, you're probably going to end up with a very different experience. It's a film I've come back to numerous times, just because of, I sort of find a new layer to it every time. I think it's one of the most sort of culturally incisive films of the decade. And even aside from that, just as a pure sort of visceral experience, it's completely unlike anything I've seen. It's hypnotic, it's bizarre, it's got incredible just experimentation in its use of the form. I had, like, again, think of those partying scenes where we start to see, like, the actual, like, sort of film just kind of, like, disintegrate as they're doing drugs. You know, you sort of see the frames pull apart. It's an insane, genius movie, and I can see why people hate it, but I fucking love it.
It's a movie about spring break that makes you think a little bit too hard about spring break. I think a lot of people are not willing to put that much thought into watching that particular movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I came out of it, I definitely saw a lot of just like how the violence like was juxtaposed over the partying, and like when you were talking about the diner scene, and also like there's a heightened climax scene towards the end where like there's even more violence. Like it's wild to see that it's just like these two white girls that have no respect for
and
culture.
The whole while they're doing it, you know, they're using lines from hip-hop songs, they're quoting hip-hop songs, they're using you know, cultural slang that again has been appropriated from the African-American community, you know.
And this is a party world for them, like,
yeah,
no repercussions.
It's just dipping their toes in and having fun. It's mm-hmm. It's not their life. It's just, you know, it's like a costume they put on. Yeah, it's a brilliant, bizarre film, and I love Harmony Korine for making it.
That's a really good pick, Nick.
Thanks, dude.
Just, you know, and if you've never seen the movie and you'd like to see an incarnation of the rapper Riff Raff, but played by James Franco, it's not Riff Raff, but it sure as fuck looks like him.
True story, this was my Halloween costume in, what is it, 2013 when the movie came out?
Hoo-wee.
Yeah. I got a lot of your Riff Raff, right?
And you just said, I'm not going to explain my costume to
you. I just
you.
Said, yeah. Why not?
All right, so we're coming down to my last movie, at least for this part of the episode. So I'm going to go with 2014 Alejandro Iñárritu's Birdman. This movie was just wild. All over the fucking place. I love the amount of planning that went into this movie. I love how strange some of the imagery can be at times. It's edited in a way to make it feel like you are constantly just there. Like it, like the way they're cut, like it's supposed to seem seamless. Like if you watched 1917, it's basically the same.
The effect of it being almost one shot.
Yeah. And just watching it and not, but like the fact that it's still one shot, but also being divided on like what's real, what's surreal, what's actually happening, who's there, is constantly just being played with. Like everything's always in front of you, but you never know what's truly happening. And even like the ending of the movie is like, what? Like it, you don't have a definitive answer at the end of the movie. Michael Keaton just delivering on something that was like, Alejandro said, if I can't get Michael Keaton, then fuck this movie. I'm not going to make it. And it's like he's playing the part of basically an old actor who used to be popular for being a superhero. Michael Keaton.
Right.
Batman, you know. And then like goes on to try to become relevant again. And it's in a place where he isn't necessarily viewed as being welcome, at least not in this particular film. So he's decided that he, just because he was a big shit back in the day, he can come back and just hit Broadway by storm with a theater adaptation of something that he saw a long time ago based on a cocktail napkin like autograph. It's visually striking, and it has one of the coolest soundtracks from that year, because it was just straight up drum solos, and I can get down with a drum solo in a movie, and just the way that it like pulses through and like pushes you forward. Cause like if you've ever heard like a drum beat in a way where you're like, oh, this is making me walk more, it makes you want to watch the film.
Yeah.
Even that much more, because as they're pacing through the hallways, in a real theater, I forget what the name of the theater was.
I'm blanking.
But like it was this real space, but the thing was they didn't get all the opportunities to just continue to shoot and like reshoot in that space. There was tons of planning that went into that movie previous to that, where they were like building fake sets using PVC pipe and like draping curtains over it and saying, okay, so this is what it's going to be like, and you have to walk through this section and you have to go through that section. It's just like it's a movie that shows you how, if you're planning it well and you can execute it well, it's got some of the most, it's got some really good acting in it. You've got Emma Stone in there as the daughter of Michael Keaton's character. You also have Edward Norton, who's just infuriating as fuck in this movie, but also very good. Naomi Watts, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just incredible cast, and just like
a great small role too from Zach Galifianakis,
a surprising role in this
movie. That
because
like that
he's,
role
because like he's still able to deliver like his comedic punches here and there, but also like just being real businessy, like when he's like the way he's delivering those lines. I think watching the featurette with him in it, he's like, I don't know why I'm in this movie. He's like, it makes no sense that I'm in this movie with these people.
Yeah, I think that's a really good pick. I'm a big fan of Birdman. Another thing I like about that movie is, you know, it is kind of like they like to make movies about making art, and this is definitely one of them. And it does grapple with sort of the idea of being defined by the art you create, as well as the fragility of fame. But the other thing about it too is you mentioned 1917, and what I kind of like about Birdman, kind of in comparison to that, is that both of these are sort of films meant to look like one take. But whereas in 1917, I almost felt like that was the spectacle of it, where it almost felt like you were watching the filmmaker go, look at this shot. Yeah. Look at this one. Birdman, it kind of just draws you deeper into the story. It doesn't ever feel like it's being done just as a trick.
Yeah.
And if anything, it's sort of something you notice as the narrative's going on, rather than having the movie call attention to itself for it. Yeah, it's a fucking awesome movie. Really good pick.
There's some incredible special effects in this movie. Like, a lot of times when people are talking about special effects, they're looking at like visual stuff that's happening. There's scenes where like Michael Keaton is fucking floating in the air, and you're like, also, this is like a one shot. This is like a one take thing where like the camera just kind of like zooms in on him in a way that allows him to like, you get right up on his like white brief underwear, and then like his legs just come down, and he's just standing. He also has these moments of like where he believes things are happening in a particular way. Like he thinks he has like telekinetic powers that he can like, you know, will things to happen in the movie. And the way those are shown in the movie are really interesting, because you feel like it's happening for the most part up until like a particular point in the movie where things are very heated, and they only reveal it to you in the smallest chunks, and usually as like a kind of like just off to the side. Like you've been in this big spectacle and you're like, oh, and then all the next thing you see is somebody like coming in to probably see what's really happening.
Yeah.
And that's, I it's love the
always
way that's
played
done.
For a good joke in the movie. That's what I like too about it. The movie's got like a great sense of humor as well to it. You know how earlier in this list we were doing this nice thing of like sort of dovetailing our picks with similar themes and vibes? I got one now. My number six kind of is somewhere in that vibe. It's a film about sort of art and what you're willing to do for your art. And it also stars somebody famous for superhero movies. My number six is Whiplash.
Ooh, nice.
Oh, also Drums.
Drums. Huge. Another, holy shit, dude.
huge movie for Drums.
Yeah, man.
Whiplash is not the debut film from Damien Chazelle, but it was his breakout film. It was kind of based on his own experiences as a student at Juilliard. I really hope to hell his instructor was not as bad as the one in this movie. But it does star J.K. Simmons in it in a performance that is incredible. I almost think when we talk, it's funny, about superhero movies, that in a way this performance from J.K. Simmons is in a way the best supervillain performance of the decade. Like, he is so...
I mean, he knows how to play an antagonist.
Yeah, but he's just so menacing and maniacal, and you can never really gauge what his intentions are, or if he's fucking with you, and if he's trying to actually destroy you or help you. But it is kind of this story just about, you know, what are you willing to do to create art? And also, will you destroy yourself in the process? Because of, essentially, it's the idea of giving up your own humanity to create something that becomes your identity. It's also just incredibly entertaining. If you told somebody a movie about a kid going to to learn drums at a music institute was the most suspenseful and thrilling movie you saw that year, they'd probably be a little suspicious. But genuinely, even still now, when I know how this movie's going to end, I'm like on the edge of my seat the entire way through. The editing in this movie is insane. It's similar where it does take up that sort of rhythmic tension to it that the music that they're playing has. But it's also just in any of the other scenes here. And then they also just do a great job of making the main character played by Miles Teller here feel like such a real human being. Like, and he's not necessarily somebody who's entirely sympathetic. Like, you understand who that person is, and he's a bit of a prick, but you can kind of understand why he is the way he is. You know, just the relationships he has with his family, who aren't fully invested or supportive of his dream, or the romantic relationships that he's not able to lend himself to, even if he's not so tactful in ending those. But the other thing about it just too is, I think flat out, this movie, and I'm not going to say what happens, has the best ending of any movie I saw this decade. When I still, to this day, when I'm like trying to, like, just bored or just like thinking about great movies, I'll put in the ending scene on YouTube and just watch it again, just because I remember the pure thrill when I saw it in theaters. The movie ended and I rarely ever stand up, and I was just like, fuck fuck, you just really ended it that way? Whole, like, I, like, the adrenaline was still just coursing through me. I, like, wanted to go fight somebody or climb a mountain or something. It's such a visceral, incredible character drama. It's got amazing performances. And I really like Damien Chazelle as a filmmaker. I was a big fan of La La Land. And First Man was a little bit more iffy for me, but I'm still very curious to see what he does with the rest of his career. But holy shit, this was a debut.
Truly wonderful film. Also a pretty great performance from Paul Reiser from Mad About You.
Yes.
Playing the dad, and just like this wonderful scene where, like, the way they do the snacks with, like, was it Raisinets and popcorn?
Raisinets and popcorn.
It's such a cute moment. Just like, you know, going to the movies with your parents and just like, oh, let's get the snacks and combine them.
What I love about that scene too is it feels like something that had to have been taken from your own life because it's so specific. Because what I really love about that is there's this tradition, and then they're sitting around, or they're sitting down to eat, and, like, he's like, oh, grab a handful. He's like, no, I don't really like Raisinets, I'll eat around them. And he's like, well, why'd you put them in? And he's like, well, I know you like, it's that kind yeah, of thing, like, you exactly. know you do with your parents. Like, it's so specific, but it creates such a real, instantly, it's just like, you understand this relationship between them.
Like a dad that really cares about his kid.
Yeah.
Like, is willing to be there through thick and thin. Like, all right, I trust your judgment, but, like, I'm going to
He's scared.
Miss, yeah,
He's
I'm
scared
genuinely
for
afraid for you. Yeah, that movie, wildly good.
Yeah.
I did watch a YouTube video from Adam Neely where he's, like, breaking it down and going, like, Juilliard is not like this, but it is similar to this.
Yeah.
So there may be professors almost as bad as this, but if they were as bad as this, they were going to get fired. Like that.
Maybe it was just that Damien Chazelle had, like, a bad relationship with one. It was like, fuck you, wait till I make my movie.
I'm gonna make my first movie about you, and I'm gonna make so much fun of you. It's gonna be great.
Yeah. Oh, man. So that was our top five for this first half of our two-part special. But we do have a few more movies we want to throw out real quick just as honorable mentions.
Yeah, a couple honorable mentions from the years where I was like, oh, there's so many good movies that came out in those years. So I'm picking from, like, specifically from 2012, like, I chose The Master. It was up between The Master and The Act of Killing, which is a documentary that, if you've never seen it, it's just... ugh, it's mind-boggling. It's stomach-churning. It's so impactful in a way. It's like, it's one of the few times where I've ever seen a documentary that pulls one over on the people that it's documenting and just kind of saying, like, hey, this documentary is meant to fuck with you.
Yeah. And spoilers real quick, I'm going to let you get back into yours, but that's also on my honorable mentions list. This was in my, like, 20 through 10, and I agree with you again. It's incredible just for the visuals and what the film creates, but also how it uses sort of its premise, which is essentially convincing Indonesian death squad, like, murderers and hitmen that they're making a movie about them.
Celebrating them.
And
almost.
They want them to play themselves recreating it. And it's watching these people have to sort of reckon with the humanity of what they've done. And it's incredible.
Yeah, I've never seen, like, facial emotion shifts in such a real way. Because it is real. And, like, to get it captured on film this way... It's devastating.
There's a scene in particular where they're recreating, they're all dressed up like cool gangsters. They're wearing white suits. And the guy who sort of strangled one of them to death is now in this scene playing the victim. And you sort of watch as he's being choked how he reckons with it. And it's...
He doesn't go very well with it.
it's an incredible piece of cinema. I don't mean to cut you off, but, you know, we just had that in common, so I'll let you leap into a couple more.
All right, so I had a couple more years. 2013, I chose Gravity. Well, there was a couple of other great films that, and one in particular that I wanted to pinpoint was Nebraska. and holy shit, this is like a movie about probably one of the most boring premises that you could go have out there. But Will Forte is in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's like the first time I've ever seen him in a movie, in a serious movie, where he plays... Who's the older actor?
Bruce Dern.
Now, Bruce Dern is just a force in this movie of like an old white man who is just like, I have to do things my way.
Angered.
And just so mad and angry about everything. And he needs to get this mail back to a place, but he doesn't trust the post office. It's just like he is the problem in the entire movie, and then Will Forte's like, all right, man, well, I'm just gonna go along with it.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna make sure that you're okay.
It's the bizarre, difficult relationship you have with your parents to kind of make sure they're all right.
Right. It's like, I'm gonna make sure that you feel independent, but I'm also gonna come along too. And just, oh, this fucking sucks. It has a little bit of a Buffalo connection. One of the news reporters for the Art Voice, Buck, I forget his last name, helped co-write one of the songs that plays in that movie.
Oh, no shit.
It plays on a jukebox in the background of a bar scene, but yeah, it's still in that movie. Movie's completely shot in black and white and just super wonderful and depressing in a strange way, but also mildly uplifting.
Yeah.
But that's not the whole thing.
There's a lot of comedy in it, too, that they mine from the situation. You know what I am shocked, though, by is, as you said, this is your Will Forte pick. You didn't go with MacGruber and stuff?
Excuse me. I never saw that movie. I can't pick it. But yeah, and then I've got one more that from 2014. It's a Lego movie. Because, oh my god, I was so excited for this dumbass movie from the day that I heard it was coming out, because I knew the Lego video games were really good. It also brings us some of the these directors, Phil Lord
and Chris Miller,
in a film where like they're really showing their colors like in a really good way, like with humor and like style, and then they did the new Spider-Man multiverse movie, and like just, you know, seeing how they progressed from that to that is like pretty incredible. If you've never seen Lego Movie and you're just not into kids films, well, too bad. You should watch it. Yeah. It's kind of wonderful.
It's hilarious. It's inventive. It's super creative. They took what, in a lot of ways, should have been... I know when this movie was announced, people were, like, joking about it. It was right. Like, you're like, really, this is going to be a movie? Like,
just a giant commercial for Legos? Great.
Yeah, yeah. But... You know what's funny about yours is that leads in perfectly to one of my honorable mentions, which is also a movie by Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Ooh-wee.
And that is 21 Jump Street.
I knew it. I knew you were going to mention it.
We talk about movies that make us, again, laugh harder than anything. And similar to Booksmart. Actually, I would say up until Booksmart, this was, for me, was the funniest movie I'd seen this decade. I watch it over and over, and the jokes never get old to me. The other thing is, I just love comedy filmmakers that play with the form. So often, when you do see comedy filmmaking, it's simply shot, reverse shot, shot, reverse shot. And they know how to use sort of editing and filmmaking to tell a joke rather than just the writing. The drug trip scene in this movie is one of the funniest set pieces I've ever seen in my life. And I was not a fan of Channing Tatum until 21 Jump Street, and now I'm all aboard the Channing bus. And also just... similar to one of your picks, this was a very early look at an actress that I don't think any of us knew was going to be as big as she was, and that was Brie Larson.
Oh, yeah.
Both in Scott Pilgrim and in 21 Jump Street. And especially here in 21 Jump Street, she gets a lot more room to play, and you can kind of see the actress she was starting to become, but a lot younger. And I'm a big 21 Jump Street fan. But a few of my other honorable mentions here. This one was very close to making my list. It's a film called Minding the Gap.
Yeah, dude.
It's a documentary by a young man named Bing Liu, who started basically just filming footage with him and his friends in Illinois as just a bunch of skateboarders, kids growing up together. And he just kept speaking with his friends and filming more footage with them as they grew older and sort of started to become adults, and about how their lives were changing and his own lives were changing, and kind of what the outlet of skateboarding was sort of an outlet from in their own personal lives. And some of them are all sort of dealing with their own trauma in their childhoods, or trauma in their personal relationships. And it's just a really brave piece of filmmaking. I couldn't imagine asking my friends some of the questions he does, and then also telling them I was going to be putting it on video and showing other people it. And it never comes off in a way where it feels like he's exploiting his friends. Every single one of these people, and some have even done some truly horrible things, he tries to treat everybody in this film and in his life with empathy, but also with an intelligence and a concern for their well-being. And the way it just sort of culminates is really beautiful, and I probably cried like fucking three times watching this movie. It's a super powerful documentary.
He was one of the youngest directors to be nominated
for an Oscar. Yeah. I believe he was 21. Mm-hmm. And then this is a movie that perhaps people thought was going to be on my list, but it's not. And that's Greta Gerwig's debut film, Lady Bird.
Ooh wee.
This
is a surprise, Nick.
I do really passionately love Greta Gerwig. I love her cinematic voice. And the sort of warmth and empathy of the worlds she creates. And I find Lady Bird a super beautiful film. Saoirse Ronan's performance in it is really incredible. And I do like that movie is sort of just snapshots of life. You know, so often when we have coming-of-age stories, it's these narratives that we have to tell about growing up. But it is kind of this look back at sort of the moments and the things we remember that slowly create the person we become. And it's powerful, it's funny, it's beautiful. Again, if we're going to talk about crying, the scene at the end where she's driving will never fail to make me cry. And I think Greta Gerwig's one of the most exciting... I don't want to just say filmmakers, because of I think her influence extends beyond that. You know, even aside from her films like Lady Bird and Little Women, you know, she co-wrote Frances Ha, she co-wrote Mistress America, starred in movies like 20th Century Women. She has a specific tone and voice for her work, and I think she brings the best out of people around her. So this was very close to making my list. It just missed it. I still love you, Greta. Don't worry.
She hears you. She knows.
I'm sorry. I truly am. But that's it for my honorable mentions for now.
Yeah, that's going to wrap up this portion of our list. But stay tuned to the next episode where you get to hear our top five. My 2015 to 2019.
Yeah. And so that was all for this half of our countdown. We'll see you at the movies.